Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of New Books in Sound Studies, a New Books Network podcast series. My name is Khadija, and I'll be your host for the day. I'm here to interview Professor Steve Rezaka on his 2020 monograph, Sonic City, Making Rock Music and Urban Life in Singapore. He recently retired as Associate Professor from the University of Lethbridge, Canada. He's also a rock music artist, and I would call Sonic City a passion project of Rezaka as a musician. Sonic City is an ethnographic project centered around a community of noisy people who make rock music within the urban life in Singapore. The heart and soul of this community is English language rock and roll music pioneered in Singapore by several members of the 1960s legendary Beats and Blues band, the Stray Dogs, who continue to engage this community in a sonic way of life. Without further delay, let me welcome Steve Rezaka on board. Thank you, Steve, for joining me today. Let me start our conversation with a curiosity about the sonic question addressed by the book. In a space like Singapore, almost filled with the sound of silence, can you detail a bit about the sonic experience of the project? Would a work on rock and roll music have manifested if you were not a musician?
That's a great question. Well, of course, a project on rock music in Singapore could continue or exist without the musician element of it. But of course, the musician aspect provided me some entry into this community. As you know, all communities kind of protect their boundaries and borders in various kinds of ways. And so, you know, I certainly could have been an anthropologist walking into the guitar shop and asking these guys if they'd be willing to consent to a project. But the musician aspect gave me an entry and access that provided more intimacy and led to the kinds of relationships that I'm sure we're going to talk about later in the podcast. So being a musician was very helpful in my case and with this community. It's not entirely necessary, but it's helpful. And that's how this all began, actually, the sonic experience of it all. I was jet lagged when I arrived to be a senior fellow at the Asia Research Institute. And so I just looked up online where the guitar shops were, because I play guitar. It's been a part of me, you know, since I was a teenager. And I went down, and this is when I started meeting people in the guitar shops. And the very first time I visited Guitar 77, there was this older guy standing behind the counter with long gray hair, And there was a guitar hanging on the rack that I wanted to play, and so I asked him if I could play it. He said yes, and I started to play, and he yelled out to me, "Oh, you're a blues man." And I said, "Well, I don't know. I don't know if I'd call myself a blues man." And so then he picked up his bass guitar. He plays bass guitar. This is Keong, Lim Keong, who is a major figure in the book. And we sat down and played an old classic blues song, Stormy Monday. And at the end of it, we both looked at each other and said, "You know, and I know we could play together." So that is kind of how this whole sonic experience began. At least within this community, I have to admit, later, not long after that encounter, a colleague invited me over for dinner, and I was walking to her house, and I walked past a mosque, and the call for prayer was, of course, turned inward, not allowed to be publicly broadcasted, and that's when I began to kind of think about sound in society seriously, and thought, wow, you know, maybe there's some kind of project or story here, at least a story that's compelling and interesting to follow. So I think any anthropologist, and you know this, you know, one of our skill is we practice a habit of noticing until it kind of becomes an art of noticing, you know, and paying attention ethnographically is kind of baked into me, and I think all of us that take on this interest and career and profession and that kind of thing. So, I mean, when I immediately started meeting the guys in the guitar shop, I began to think ethnographically, and so that's how this whole book and my experience with this community began.
That's an amazing answer. The methodological core of the project is sonic ethnography, which starts from the basement of Peninsula Shopping Center, a veteran mall that sells musical instruments and spare parts. Through sonic ethnography, you are trying to study the Singaporean popular culture. Please share a bit more about sonic ethnography to our listeners. How is it different from an quote-unquote ordinary ethnography?
Well, it's not really. I used and continue to use, you know, kind of old and tried and true ethnographic methods of long-term field work, learning the language, participant observation, interviews. For this project, I didn't do many formal interviews. They were mostly unstructured, kind of emergent conversations. There were some differences for this. One, sonic ethnography for me is not so much paying attention to the sonics of some soundscape, although that's part of it for sure. But sonic ethnography for me is attention to the social life of sound, to kind of reference Arjuna Poddar and his social life of things. And that's what intrigued me about this project. And you know, I call it a project, and it is a project. When I talked with all of the guys about it, we discussed it as a project to make sure everyone knew that some analysis was going to come out of this, some writing, and perhaps a book, and that kind of thing. What happened was I began to take seriously, you know, the notion that sonic participations and the making of sonic knowledge can constitute a way of life and living. And I picked this up from another ethnomusicologist and anthropologist working on music and sound. Simon Frith, you know, once said that making music isn't a way of expressing ideas, it's a way of living them. And that influenced me greatly. Stephen Feld, in a similar note, And his work with jazz musicians in Ghana referred to this living with sound as an acoustomology, a way of knowing the world through sound. So these ideas that were already circulating in publication and that kind of thing, and work on sound, it influenced me greatly. And so my methods were organized around acoustomologies, communities who produce a way of knowing the world through sound. And that's kind of how I organize my methodology. Again, the methodology for sonic ethnography, it draws greatly upon traditional ethnographic methods. As I said, the participant observation and interview and long-term field work. The long-term element is very important to this, as you know from your own work. I mean, over the 6 years that this was a project, and I'm still in touch with these guys. In fact, I'm going back next month for a concert, a memorial concert to celebrate the life of a legendary Singaporean guitarist, Jimmy Apadurai Chua, who just recently passed. But the long-term element was key, because that's how trust and rapport and between myself and the people I got to know in this community was established. And that trust and rapport allowed me to go much deeper into this project than I could have without any of that, as just a kind of researcher showing up in the community and that kind of thing. So the methods included traditional ethnography. We also, I of course consulted a whole variety of cultural studies and ethnomusicology and other anthropologies of sound and music. In addition to the ethnographic methods as they take place in Singapore, this was a multi-sided ethnography. We traveled as a band and as a community. Usually when we traveled to play in other Southeast Asian cities, we had a whole group of us that followed along. Social media and devices of all kinds played a huge role in this, especially WhatsApp and other social media sites and ways of communicating. Our recordings of music from the past and our own recordings of ourselves were great sources of data for me. was a central feature of this community in the first place. I had the opportunity to access different kinds of archives. So the National Library has a collection of oral histories done in the 90s with some of the major 1960s Singapore musicians. I also met fans and local historians who were intensely interested in this period and had huge collections of records and 45s and posters and all kinds of artifacts that were relevant to this community I was working with. Remember, this community was organized for the most part around a group of musicians that were multi-generational, but the 1960s guys, Lim Ki-young, James Tan, and the other Stray Dogs were a kind of central force, organizing force for this entire group. Being able to kind of peruse someone's collection of records and posters and tickets and all kinds of things, magazines, was really useful The other thing we did methodologically that was unusual was we wrote music together. And this, we decided, we were conscious about it. I said, look, guys, I'm an anthropologist. I like to tell stories about the everyday. How about we write music about everyday stories as they happen in over the course of this project? And that's what we did. And so we wrote a number of original compositions that just reflected things that were happening to us. I wrote about going in the Capitiam shop and having Kaya toast, and we called named that song Shokla because the taste was so shok, and just being there was so shok. And we wrote a composition about when I passed out during a rehearsal. I'm an old guy, you know, so things happen. I passed out and I ended up in the hospital, and we wrote a tune about that. We wrote a tune about going to Yangon in Myanmar, and so on. So that part of the methodology was incredibly useful because it brought us into conversation in ways that are not typical to kind of ethnographic interview, whether it's structured, unstructured, open-ended, or whatever. So that pretty much covers the methods.
I really enjoyed those songs, being honest. And the monograph is also the story of a bunch of rock musicians who are sometimes called noisy people, as you put it. It also contributes to the noise question of Singapore as an urban space. Noise is an essential entity when it comes to rock music production. How would you describe this?
Sonically, it is highly regulated. Everyone's living so close together, and sound is a force that spreads or has the capacity to spread. And so therefore, the responses can be many, like listening or shutting the door, you know. And so I guess beginning with that walk to my colleague's house for dinner and noting that the call for prayer was turned inward within the mosque, that began to, you know, say to me, let's pay attention to sound as you're, you know, doing your work around here, walking around this place. One thing I noticed was in HDB flats, they often have a monthly meeting of members of the community board of the, you know, HDB flat or whatever. And there would be these whiteboards in which the agenda was laid out for the meeting. And more often than not, I saw a number of these, the term or the concept of noise pollution appeared over and over and over again. And so the community would rate different activities that take place in the void deck in terms of noise pollution. And of course, weddings, especially Malay weddings, funerals, senior events, all of these were rated in terms of noise pollution. And so therefore could be discussed amongst community members. And that was kind of a clue to me that I needed to pay attention to the zoning aspects and the ways in which city spaces are zoned in order to manage sound and noise. A friend of mine is a sound engineer, and he's called in as new complexes are being built and so forth in order to kind of measure and manage the problems of sound. I mean, this is life, especially from a sonic perspective, that it's going to face regulation. Back in the day, and it still happens today, there was the public entertainment Act that back in the 60s was legislated to keep sound at a minimum. So groups of people could not form without a license and make sound. You had to get a license. Back in that day, when Keong and James and the Stray Dogs were just beginning to emerge, the government was worried about these sonics and instituted a campaign called the Yellow Culture Campaign, which was meant to silence the sounds of rock music, especially English language rock music, because it, of course, embodied all of these terrible Western values and drug life and hippies and this kind of thing. So sound as noise or noise as sound has always been a feature of kind of the modernity of Singaporean history and contemporary life, and continues today. As it comes to rock music, I mean, it has changed over time. As I said, the Yellow Culture years of the late 60s and early 70s have now receded into the years in which rock music and English language rock music is being recognized as a part of national heritage. So these things shift over time. And so now the rock music scene is actually rather lively in Singapore these days, even compared to when I started all of this back in 2011, 2012. It has changed dramatically. So that's my take on noise.
The cultural heritage revival done by Singapore and the role of Stray Dogs, the rock music band, as a vernacular and intangible heritage is brought up in the text. As part of the cultural heritage conservation, you have all performed in venues of national importance like the Esplanade. Is there a difference when you perform, say, in Esplanade compared to that of a venue like the Hood situated currently in a mall?
Oh, my goodness. Huge differences. Yes, absolutely huge. But nonetheless, as Lily Kong once wrote, these notions of heritage, whether national or local vernacular, converge and diverge in a variety of different ways. So even at the Esplanade, the convergence and divergence of different kinds of heritage were present, and as they are at the Hood, you know, local bar with live music. This was one of the most interesting aspects of the project to me, was I got to be a part of and involved in heritage making. It was remarkable. Remember, I refer to the Stray Dogs as vernacular heritage. And in the book, remember that the Stray Dogs are a Katong band. Okay, they're from Katong. All of the brothers and friends that form the band walk the streets of Katong. They actually wrote a song, Walking the Streets of Katong. And this is a close-knit community that transcended racial and ethnic lines. It's a mixed kind of community located along Singapore's East Coast. This community is considered the traditional home of the island's Peranakan community, Straits-born Chinese. Katong's colonial era began with as a plantation area, and then that later was reconstructed as a recreation retreat for rich Chinese businessmen. In the early 20th century, Katong was kind of a wealthy suburb where English language education was established with the area's first schools, you know. So with the demise of plantations, the East attracted kind of Eurasian families, and encouraged in part by the English language schools, and as well as the establishment of churches and Christianity in the area. Piranhacans, even though they spoke in the kind of Creole or patois of Piranhacan, they all spoke English as well. And so the cultural history of the kind of urban development of Kantong led to a kind of family life that you'll hear in Keong stories and in James stories, in which English was common. And the community was cosmopolitan in outlook and demeanor, you know, for all of these different reasons. And this is the vernacular heritage that emerges often as this community, and especially this generation within the community, get together to play music, to hang out, to have dinner, to, you know, whatever event is going on. So that vernacular heritage, when we would rehearse, would be central. And after, you know, rehearsing our music, we'd come out and sit around in the common area where the rehearsal studios were. And that Katong was everywhere, haunting everything that we did. And other friends from those days would be there listening to us or waiting to finish rehearsal. So, and then we'd get together and eat food and drink whiskey and all this kind of stuff. And it was Katong at the very center. And so this is what I refer to and others refer to as kind of vernacular heritage made from the ground up. Whereas national heritage, as we just mentioned, you know, its history didn't always embrace this sonics, and but had begun to about 4 or 5 years after I arrived, and kind of a rethinking of popular culture in the national history of Singapore was beginning. And so the playing at the Esplanade was, of course, a huge site of national heritage, which wants to sanitize, for the most part, the drugs and hippiness and all of these kinds of things from that era. And so we were presented at the Esplanade with two performers who represented those highly sanitized sonic spaces back in the 60s and 70s. Veronica Young, who was and Vernon Cornelius, English language Singaporean musicians. I think Veronica is known as the Connie Francis of Southeast Asia. So that gives you a sense of it. And Vernon, I think, was known back then as the Cliff Richard of the shadows of Southeast Asia. So we arrive at the Esplanade. But before we arrive, the Esplanade wanted to see all of our music lyrics. They wanted to see our set list. We had to turn that all in first before we could even begin thinking about performing for that concert. The producer of the concert was certainly a bit aware and a bit afraid of that he might lose control of us. And so he was not checking in on Veronica, and he was not checking in on Vernon in the way that he was checking in on us. He was afraid we were back in the dressing room drinking, maybe even smoking cigarettes. And you know, that kind of thing. He was worried that we wouldn't be able to perform our set professionally and within the time frame that we were given. So all of these things related to kind of the vernacular of rock music and these particular guys, the Stray Dogs, known to be kind of an alternative in the music scene. That appeared in the dressing room. When we took the stage, a couple colleagues of mine from NUS were out in the audience, and some Singaporeans turned to them, and as we started to play, said to them, "These guys were the alternative back then." And so, you know, that kind of convergence of different heritages, local and national, were very common in across different performance venues, whether it was the Hood, where it would be deeply, deeply embedded in local vernacular heritage and of rock music, katong, or any other kind of aspect of that milieu. Whereas, you know, at the Esplanade, we kind of had to clean it up a little bit. But we surprised the heck out of the producer. We did the set within the allotted time almost exactly. And it went very well. And the audience just responded with enthusiasm. So, and so much so that when Vernon came out after us, he started commenting on our band and our performance and on the Stray Dogs. I'm the one who invited the Stray Dogs up to Orchard Road. I'm, you know, this kind of thing. They never would have got a chance to play the Golden Venus if it hadn't been for me. So, you know, it was these convergences and divergences that I found fascinating.
So your experiences of engaging with the sounds of a Javanese kampung or village helped in bringing deep sound as a conceptual category to study sounds. Deep sounds act as a metaphor for the cosmopolitan life in Singapore, entangled in its urbanities. How does deep sound reflect the urban life in Singapore?
Okay, well... Yeah, I worked on that idea, as you say, when I was living in a kampung, an urban neighborhood in the city of Yogyakarta on the island of Java. And how that began was a neighbor and some of the men from the neighborhood started some kronjong rehearsals. Kronjong is a guitar string music that was brought to Southeast Asia by the Portuguese and closely resembles the Portuguese fado music. And of the sudden appearance of these music rehearsals and what to make of them in the context of kampung social relations. So I began thinking about sound kind of then. And one of the things that is required of all kampung residents is to keep their places clean. And every afternoon around 3 o'clock, you're expected to go out in front of your house and clean up the road in front of your house. And this is noted through sound. You begin to hear the brooms sweep across the road through your window. And that's when I got it. I said, you know, okay, if sweeping as a sound is making social relations, kind of, you know, reminding us all of the moral obligations to our community and keeping it clean, then making music must be the same thing too. And so as I thought about the sweeping, the sound of the broom coming in through the window, I began to kind of associating that with other philosophers and who were working on sound, and that noted that sound spreads in space, so it has the capacity to connect, to share, and therefore to evoke contact and participation. And that's what really clued me into this notion of deep sound, that an ethos and a social life could be actualized in sonic representation, that sound promotes the formation of social groupings, and the capacity of sound, just like the sweeping of the broom, to circulate and exchange attention to moral life. For me, these aspects of sound, and if they're there, make it deep. Okay. And that's what I meant by deep sound. So for the urban scene in Singapore, and especially in this community, the sound, as I learned from this community that I worked with and learned from, that there were some kind of also similar presences within the sonic life of this community. And one was a cosmopolitanism and a cosmopolitan conviviality. And what I mean by that is the willingness of the members of the community to lean into difference. You know, that to me was like one of the great lessons of life. I experienced that, this leaning into difference as a kind of, again, a habit. The other aspect was the vernacular heritage that we talked about. And the other was, this community was men and women, uncles and aunties and young people and so forth and so on. But there's the circulating kind of social subject was often a masculine one. And so masculinity was present at all times in this community, and making rock music and enjoying rock music. But also within the community, this masculinity had a kind of fraternity that all of us were engaged in, that actually in many ways was organized around caring for each other, you know, as men, but as a community too, you know. And so to me, that was the depth of these sonic experiences I would call deep sound in with these in this Singaporean urban milieu with this particular community of musicians, family, and friends.
From social relations, we are going to the idea of sonic ethics, where sonic obligations are formed through the multi-sensory ways of music production. This ethics is a part of the moral economy that you were also a part. How was your experience of being a part of such give and takes?
Okay, well, again, this was another fascinating aspect of all of this. Remember, you know, anthropologists like to talk about, when they talk about economics and economic anthropology and so forth, like to talk about different forms of exchange. And the dominant form of exchange here in this community was reciprocity. Okay. And not contract market exchange where I pay for disinterested, they call it sometimes, where I pay you for something and get very transactional, right? Reciprocity establishes and encourages enduring relationships anchored in obligation and trust, you know? And of course, we can break those obligations and trust, and then the relationship often falls apart. But this was the basis of the moral economy of this community. It involved a broader kind of materiality of things that include sound and genre and people and urban space, all active in what I refer to, referencing Latour, as assemblages. And the emphasis on reciprocal exchange in this community was again, to me, very interesting, because it kind of flew in the face of the stereotypes and expectations that we have around economic life in Singapore, rational economic behavior, capitalist, you know, consumption and production, for profit and wealth and these kinds of things. In fact, the reciprocity, the the moral economy of this group would be seen as kind of irrational from that perspective, and was often referred to by people I knew in Singapore as irrational. Sometimes someone would say their business model isn't very good, you know, and so then I realized that I was kind of on to something. And so the sonic expressions within this moral economy is a kind of political economy that is at odds with the rational developmental state of that is Singapore. And again, Keang often himself blamed the trajectory of his life and life chances on his own bad business model, which kind of based in a gift logic, an approach to life for his ups and downs, unsound business practices. So that's what really struck me. And you picked up on it very nicely, in that the actual playing of music as a band is reciprocal. In fact, enforces reciprocity as we exchange licks and keep ourselves on track through paying attention to how we're playing and what we're playing and the sonics of it all. It enforces that notion. And being in a band enforces that notion on its own, because you have to show up. You have to be there. So you're obligated. You were saying, I'm in this relationship and I'm obligated to, you know, show up and be there and practice and perform. And so all around, this kind of moral economy of reciprocity is embedded in various aspects of daily life and celebrated. So my experience in the give and take, I mean, it took a while. I had to figure out what it was I could give and take. And that's one of the beauties of ethnography, right? You know, and the long-termness, we get to figure that stuff out. And so the expectations related to me were different than those among the other members of the group. And the expectations and obligations and trust also vary depending on people's background, usually wealth, whether someone had a good job or not. You know, some of the older guys that were becoming retired or so forth and were established economically, often paid for some of the things, you know. Were they expected to? Yeah, kind of. You know, I wasn't held in that same set of obligations and trust. If I flew out to a conference or flew out of Singapore, I was expected on the way back through the airport to grab a bottle of whiskey and bring it to the next gathering. I mean, it was those kinds of things. So I had to live the give and take. They're finally letting me give a little bit. For the longest time, it was hard for me to find a way to give, but that was forming the band, writing music, writing the book.
Sound, be it in the form of music or noise, is a community maker in the study. Sound entails the stories of the making of male friendships. Can you speak a bit about your friendship with your interlocutors?
Well, this sometimes is hard for me to talk about. When I wrote this section of the book, I didn't know how to do it. It's so personal and deeply emotional for me because my life with these guys remains intimate and strong. And I hadn't had friends along these lines for quite a while as my academic career proceeded. so it was deeply moving for me to become friends with them. I try to describe it as a kind of relationship between the instrumental and the effective. I mean, there were certainly some instrumental elements of it all. I'm foreign talent at an Asia Research Institute, fell into this community and began thinking about it as a project. So there were those kinds of instrumentalities associated with it. I mean, we relied on each other in various ways, economically and socially and so forth. So there were those kinds of instrumentalities in all of this. And over time, the affect of our relationships became deeper and deeper, so much that we could get mad at each other, you know, and that kind of, and not talk to each other for a while, you know, and that kind of thing. I think in one way that the kind of moral economy that we just spoke of within the community, organized around reciprocity, helped foster the intimacies of becoming friends. Now, you know, if you read the literature and anthropology on friends, especially from the point of view of an anthropologist, many critics argue that this is just a social construction or the imagination of the anthropologist deeply in need of friends. And there is some of that, I think, you know, for sure. But also, it was the way we were there for each other over and over and over again. And the trust and obligation associated with that, that I mean, I'm safe to say, and I think Kiang and James and others would say, we're friends. And again, this shaped the work in ways that, because it shaped our conversations, it shaped our activities a little differently than I had done research previously on diabetes. I'm a medical anthropologist, basically, and then I did this project on rock music in Singapore, and I did not have that degree of you know, intimacy with the guys I was working with in the VA clinic and in the United States who were managing their diabetes, are the hospitals and the clinics I worked in Indonesia with doctors and sufferers of diabetes who were trying to manage their disease. This was totally different. I think in some ways the friendship shaped what I wrote about. And whereas that didn't enter the picture so much with the diabetes research. And I'll say this, one of the ways that the friendship shaped what I wrote about was I didn't write about some things, you know, that I thought would be inappropriate since we were not using pseudonyms. We were not disguising the places. You can find all of these guys and all of the places in Singapore today. So it kind of censored me in some ways in terms of what I wrote about.
The book also contributes to the discourse of inter-Asian connections through the sonic circuits formed as part of performances in Asian urban centers like Ho Chi Minh City or Melaka. What would you like to talk about these inter-Asian experiences that you had as a musician and ethnographer?
Aha, boys trips. That's what they're called. Boys trips. So again, that masculinity, fraternal care, that kind of stuff is all circulating in as we traveled. Malacca and KL was in there at one point, and Ho Chi Minh City a couple of times. And as boys trips, the travel kind of heightened that those ideas around masculinity and fraternal care. As you see in the book, if you I use a lot of WhatsApp communication as we're traveling around Ho Chi Minh City and so forth. And it's all about caring for each other. The other aspect of it is that two things have really surprised me. One was I got an interesting perspective on Singaporean notions of urban modernity. Every place we traveled was not quite as modern as Singapore, or it was the way Singapore was in the past. You know, I found that fascinating, especially when we were in Myanmar. This was a common theme, but Ho Chi Minh City too. The other, it was a kind of curious insight on Singaporeans' feelings about where they are at in terms of development, modernity. The other aspect that was interesting was, and you can see this in the WhatsApp communications, is that the activities that we were involved in, besides performing shows, replicated what I had read about as R&R activities that American military and British military became involved in during the American war in Vietnam. And Singapore was an R&R site. And so when we would go to these other places, getting your teeth fixed, buying cheap meds, getting massages, getting a haircut, all of these kinds of attentions to the body that were very common R&R activities of military men back in the day, a kind of filled our daily schedule, okay, especially Ho Chi Minh City. And so that really struck me. And as I thought about it, wasn't surprising given the generation of guys that I was hanging out with. The other aspect of this was when we were in Ho Chi Minh City, this was my first time to Saigon. I'm 69 years old. I grew up as a teenager protesting the Vietnam War in the United States very intensely. I hardly ever went to school. I was out in the streets or involved in some kind of organizing or that kind of thing. And so we pulled into Ho Chi Minh City and drove past the American embassy where the helicopters had evacuated American personnel as the Americans were losing the war. And that resonated with me very differently than the guys I was sitting next to. This even became more clear. We were performing a show. And after the end of the show, we went up to a rooftop restaurant to celebrate. And we were passing around an acoustic guitar and stuff. And the Singaporeans kind of saw it as a different kind of space than I was experiencing it and seeing it. And for me, it was the site of all of this history in the United States of being a war protester. I couldn't believe I was in Saigon. I had to pinch myself when we were playing music and playing an old Jimi Hendrix song. I couldn't believe I was in Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, playing Jimi Hendrix. You know, I mean, it was, I had kind of out of body experiences. For them, it was a kind of modernity in their history that continued but resonated a little differently. Keong had wanted, and the Stray Dogs had wanted to play the military bases in Saigon in late 1960s. Keong's father wouldn't let him do it because he would be exposed to heroin and Western values and you know, come back an addict and all this kind of stuff. And I could tell from the we sang Route 66 and all these kind of songs about modernity in the United States, and I could tell that in their experiences it had been they had seen it as a place of a kind of modernity that they could participate in and nurture English language rock music or whatever. All of that was present and fascinating as we traveled around Southeast Asia.
The sonic circulations of the text are an assemblage of multiple actors, including human and non-human networks. It contributes to a politics of musicking, involving spatial, temporal, and even linguistic questions of Singapore as a city space. Can you explain more about the city's sonic circulations and musicking?
Yeah, oh boy, this is a huge question. I mean, I think to begin with this, I mean, the main analytic kind of used in the book is one that works inductively, which we anthropologists like to do. Observing relationships involved in phenomenon that Latour refers to as the social. And relationships that are assembled and reassembled in spatial temporalities, right? Requiring and engaging associations of heterogeneous elements, whether it be the guitar, the genre, the musician, the lick, the stage, the on and on and on. And so this is where I was going with that kind of association of heterogeneous elements of human and non-human mediators and intermediaries that for me and drawing upon Latour forms the social. So that was always present in this book. I also, similar to Iowa Ong, considered the city as a milieu, as a field of kind of intervention, again, an assemblage in which individuals and populations and groups and put into conjunction, again, as an assemblage, different elements and events and associations and images and activities as a way of being in the world. I think Iowa Ong refers to it as worlding. So from that perspective, and this may be one of the weaknesses of the book, that it appears that I ignore any kind of racial or ethnic social relations, and in fact, I don't, our gender, I don't seem to discuss those in terms of our relationships and discourse and that kind of thing, because I am interested in working inductively and observing relationships involved in phenomenons. Now, Latour kind of argues for this because he's arguing against the application of kind of deductive reasoning, coming in with a model that then we see the participations involved in that model. And for Singapore, of course, it's either the Chinese, Malay, Indian, other model of racial and ethnic relations, and gender, oftentimes from the perspective of kind of Chinese Singaporeans. And so I allow that to emerge in the book, but don't identify it or focus on it. And so people were who read the book, some were upset with that because they thought I was ignoring power and that kind of thing. But that's not what I was interested in. I was interested in how that manifested within this group, and it manifested as cosmopolitan conviviality. You know, it's not that there weren't tensions among different people of ethnic backgrounds, When you would rehearse in the studio, there was us and there were Malay bands and doing kind of different kinds of music and that kind of thing. But we would all end up in the common area afterwards. And if we were drinking and the Malay guys weren't, well, so what? You know, I mean, and we would talk music and the how terrible the rehearsal space was or whatever, that kind of thing. So that was played down. And the woman who accepted my book for publication for NUS described it to me as a friendly book. And I think that is an apt description and what I was going for. Although I certainly agree that I could have explored you know, some of the social relationships in terms of power dynamics a little more so. I mean, it's clear that I was kind of enamored with the egalitarianism of the community and the group, and that's what I experienced over the 6 years with these guys, and so that's what I wanted to come forth in my analysis.
Going to our last question, the cosmopolitanism in the project is an embodiment of the sonic history of Singapore. You bring in sonic resonance as a way of understanding the modernity question enmeshed with the city's cosmopolitan nature. Can you briefly discuss on this aspect of your work?
Yeah, I mean, this is remember, there are multiple modernities going on here, right? I mean, remember we talked about Katong and the neighborhood and the composition of that neighborhood and its history and the kind of centrality of the English language. This certainly was a kind of modernity that not experienced in other places in Singapore, right? I mean, and these guys embodied this kind of modernity and continued to nurture it throughout their lives. There are other modernities in Singapore experienced in different ways by different groups of people. So in some ways, the kind of history Keong's history, James' history, all the other guys that came from this neighborhood shaped my emphasis on cosmopolitanism. Now, however, you know, as I begin the book, Singapore is a crossroads and always has been a crossroads, even before it was a British colony, you know, its location geographically and historically have made this place a place where people lean into difference, you know, in particular ways. It's advantageous in a crossroads, you know. But like for blues music, the crossroads is a particularly important historical moment when a very famous blues player, Robert Johnson, in the early 20th century, finds himself at a crossroads, talking with the devil, asking the devil to give him the gift of blues music. And so it's kind of a his life becomes Robert Johnson's life becomes very difficult after that. So this kind of, but yet he's an incredible blues player. So this kind of Faustian bargain with that takes place at the crossroads is something that I think, you know, appears most prominently in the kind of approach of the Singaporean state to manage its affairs so authoritatively. You know, there are other aspects of that bargain and that experience of being at the crossroads that are particular to Singapore. But again, it's always been a crossroads. It continues to be a crossroads. And to me, this inflects cosmopolitanism within the city-state of Singapore in a variety of ways and angles, depending on who you're with, where you're hanging out, that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Thank you, Steve Firzaka, for joining the New Books Network. I'll be back soon with another new book. Stay tuned.